From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the updated COVID-19 vaccine and how to get it.
When you get the newest vaccine, you have the most up-to-date protection. The other thing that's newer about this is just a simplified dosing schedule.
Then we'll learn how the Wisconsin Historical Society preserves political artifacts and hear about some of the things they have from elections of the past.
I think what's really interesting about these items is you see how political campaigns have changed over the years, but also how they stay the same. You know, we have buttons from the 60s. We collected buttons at the recent convention.
Plus, we'll hear from a young Milwaukee filmmaker behind a documentary that explores the wild wetlands outside of Madison. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. A federal program has ended, making it harder for uninsured Wisconsinites to get a free COVID-19 vaccine. The Bridge Access Program provided free COVID-19 vaccines for those uninsured or underinsured. Dr. Ben Weston is Milwaukee County's chief health policy advisor. He says the updated COVID-19 vaccine could cost people without health insurance upwards of $200. But with the help of some local health departments, there will be a limited supply of free COVID-19 vaccines. Lake Effect's Excrent Nunez is joined by Dr. Weston to learn about the latest COVID-19 vaccine rollout.
Late last month, the Food and Drug Administration approved new COVID booster shots, which comes at a time when most of the U.S., including Wisconsin, is still caught up in a summer wave of COVID. How are these new COVID vaccines different from previous ones?
Yeah, so there's a few differences. I think the most important difference is that they're updated. And that means that they target the most recent, the newest variant or strain. It's an alphabet soup of variants, but for those who want detail, it's the KP2 variant. And so that's what's going around. It still is Omicron, which everybody has probably heard of, but it's the latest. And so when you get the newest vaccine, you have the most up-to-date protection. The other thing that's newer about this is just a simplified dosing schedule. So for most adults, you only need one dose of this vaccine to stay protected. Now, for certain folks who are older or have immunocompromise, they may want to get a second dose partway through the year. But long story short, this is an updated vaccine to maintain your immunity as much as possible against COVID.
Interesting. So around the same time that these new COVID vaccines were approved, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sunsetted the Bridge Access Program. Can you explain what this program was designed to do and why it ended?
Right. So the Bridge Access Program was a federal program. It ensured that uninsured individuals could still get vaccinated. But unfortunately, now that the landscape of COVID has changed, that's no longer the case. And so that makes, to be frank, for a more complex landscape of how to go about getting your vaccine, depending on whether you have insurance or you don't have insurance. So for folks who have insurance, whether it's private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, they should be covered. And probably the easiest thing is to go to your pharmacy. And your pharmacy, you can ask them, but typically will cover anyone with any of those insurances to get the vaccine. Where it becomes trickier is for folks who don't have any insurance. And so for those individuals, it's more challenging. They have to search a little bit more. I think the easiest thing to do is contact your local health department, whether that's a municipal health department or a county health department. Call them up, tell them you don't have insurance and you're looking to get the COVID vaccine. I'll tell you, in Milwaukee, for example, the Milwaukee Health Department is offering the COVID vaccine for free to individuals without insurance who are residents of Milwaukee. So that's one example of a health department using the funding that they have to overcome this lack of the Bridge Access Program. But to be sure, it is a more complex landscape than it was a year ago.
Right. It definitely sounds like this will be a huge hit to people who are uninsured and underinsured. I know in Milwaukee County alone, nearly 10% of residents are uninsured. And you mentioned the ways that Milwaukee County's Department of Health and Human Services is managing this. I guess with the timing of all of this going on, how is the Department of Health managing this obstacle?
Yeah. So one clarifying point, the county, of course, doesn't have a health department. We have municipal health departments. So the health department I was talking about is the City of Milwaukee Health Department is offering the vaccine free or low cost for folks who don't have insurance. Other health departments in Milwaukee County are as well. But that gap can be challenging to fill. And it comes at a difficult time when we have increased vaccine hesitancy among members of the community. And the last thing we want to do is put up more barriers to getting that vaccine. Really, we want to take down, just like we have throughout the pandemic, and put COVID aside, it's for any vaccine. We want to take down barriers as much as possible for vaccines, for healthcare access. And this is an added barrier that people have to overcome. Hopefully, it's a small barrier. Hopefully, with health departments engaged and pharmacies engaged, it's not too hard to overcome and to find the vaccine for free. But it is an extra step.
So for someone who is uninsured or underinsured, if they were to get the newest COVID vaccine, it could cost them upwards of $200. Do you know what makes this vaccine so expensive, or what makes up the cost of this vaccine?
Yeah, it's not inexpensive. $200 is a significant amount for most folks. And that price reflects all sorts of costs. It involves the cost of research to get the vaccine developed, the cost of manufacturing that vaccine, distributing, administering the vaccine. So there's a lot of different things that are bundled up in that cost. But for the end user, for the person who's looking to get vaccinated, they don't really care how that cost came about. It's too high. And so hopefully, whether it's through their insurance coverage or through their local health department, they can bring that cost down to $0 and get a vaccine to protect themselves, protect their family, and make sure they can stay healthy through the winter.
Right. And we're right around the corner of flu season. Why aren't COVID-19 vaccines more readily available and free, like the flu shot, for instance?
It's a great question. And the federal funding program, the Bridge Access Program, made them much more on parity with the flu vaccine. But of course, we're not seeing that now. I'm hopeful in the future that we'll see more bundling of the vaccines. It'd be great to just get one shot, cover COVID and flu together. There was talk of that coming this year. Obviously, it didn't quite come in time. But hopefully in the future, we'll see those bundled together and we'll see them offered for free.
And you already mentioned a few, but do you know of any other local health departments or programs offering free COVID vaccines?
Yeah, it really does differ depending on the health department. And part of the reason why is because our health departments differ so much. The Milwaukee Health Department, for example, is a huge health department. And because they're so large, they also are able to pursue certain sources of funding, whether that's grants, federal funding, state funding, local funding. Some of our health departments in Milwaukee County are just very, very small. And you go outside of the county to other health departments throughout the state and throughout the country, and you'll see a huge variety of resources, whether it's personnel resources or financial resources. And so, as you mentioned, the vaccine is $200 per. And so you can imagine for a small health department to stock up on a bunch of vaccines at $200 per vaccine and then potentially not use all of them, that could be a big hit to their budget. And so it is a challenging state for health departments to provide this. We're certainly thankful that Milwaukee Health Department is able to continue providing it. But your best bet is to call your local health department and see if they have a solution for you. And if they don't, if they might be able to refer you somewhere else that does.
Right. And so even as we're coming out of a summer surge of COVID cases, do you expect cases to go up again in the winter?
Yeah, so it's really hard to predict, but certainly what we've seen with COVID is that during the summer and during the winter, we tend to see spikes. It's not, I don't think, quite as defined as seasonality quite yet, but we do have several years of data, and each winter we have seen an increase in COVID. Right now we're seeing signs of a decline, which we could be thankful for the current increase we've had. And of course, we want to look at all this in perspective. This increase is nothing near what we've seen before with COVID, but nonetheless, we have folks getting hospitalized, especially when you look at the population over 65, and we can talk about why that's such an important group to focus on. But we are seeing a decline right now, and I would say, looking at the past few years, it's very likely that come winter, we'll see an increase again. And to restate it, I don't think it'll be an increase like we've seen years ago, where we're seeing massive levels of hospitalizations and deaths, but I do think it's likely that we'll see an uptick in the amount of COVID.
And you touched on this about who's getting affected mostly by COVID. I just wanted to clarify, who should be getting vaccinated once these booster shots roll out?
So the simple answer is everyone. Everyone 6 months and older should get this vaccine. It's the safest way to effectively obtain immunity from COVID. There's no doubt about that. But then we can drill down a little bit. And if we really want to target our resources, which we have to, it really is older age groups, specifically 65 and older. So to put that into context, back when we had the surge from Omicron back in January of 2022, that was when we had just skyrocketing hospitalizations. We were worried about hospital capacity. At that time, older age groups were hospitalized at a rate about twice as high as the next oldest age group, the kind of middle-aged groups, okay? But now we're seeing the older age groups hospitalized at five times a higher rate. We just didn't see that sort of dichotomy from COVID in the past. And so that tells us that while the pandemic has largely normalized for a lot of the population, it hasn't done so as much for that 65 plus. And so that's where we really need to focus our efforts. So whether it's your friends, your family, your neighbors, if you know folks over 65, those are the folks to encourage to get vaccinated. Offer them a ride, talk about your experiences. Those are the people to really try to get vaccinated. We just didn't see a high enough uptake. Last year's updated vaccine in the fall was only received by about 29% of folks over 65 in the U.S. So we just didn't hit the numbers we needed to last year. And hopefully we can target it and do as well, if not better, this year.
Well, a follow-up to that, when's the best time to get vaccinated?
Yeah, so let's do a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is whenever you can get it. If you fit it in between work, if you fit it in between your other activities, if you happen to be at the grocery store when they're offering, whatever it is, get the vaccine when you can get it. Now, if you have the time and you have the flexibility to kind of target when you get it, you can get more nuanced here. So for example, if you've recently been infected with COVID, you certainly want to wait to get the vaccine. You want to give it a couple of months for that immunity that you got from the infection to sort of wear off a little bit so you can get that boost from the updated vaccine. Likewise, if for some reason, this would be unusual, but if for some reason you decided to get the older vaccine, the previous vaccine in the last couple of months, you'd also want to wait to get your updated vaccine. Give it 2-3 months. Now, the other reason why people may want to wait is if you want to be a little bit strategic and gamble a little bit on when the winter surge is likely to come. So with most of the winter surges, we've seen it around January or so, and we're just coming out of our current increase. And so one could argue you wait till kind of later in October, you get your COVID vaccine at that point, and then you let your immunity last a little bit longer. Who knows? Maybe the spike will be December this year. Maybe it'll be November. Maybe it won't come at all. It's hard to say. But that's another reason why folks may want to wait. Now, some reasons not to wait are if you are in a high-risk group. If you're over 65, if you're immunocompromised, those would be some reasons why you'd probably want to go get the vaccine right away. Just maintain your protection because we know right now there's a lot of COVID going around. Everybody probably knows somebody who has COVID. Hopefully they're not getting real sick, but certainly if you're in one of those higher risk groups, you could get real sick.
Right. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think the take-home point is that this is the time of year to think about maintaining your health through vaccines. And we have the COVID vaccine. We didn't talk too much about the flu vaccine. If you're in a certain age group, especially 70 and older, you want to think about the RSV vaccine. And so there are these simple, easy ways to maintain your health and make sure that if you do get sick, you're laying on the couch watching TV for a day or two rather than laying in the hospital for several days on end and potentially getting even sicker. So now is the time. Talk to your friends, talk to your family, especially if they're over that age 65, and make sure they've got the right vaccines to stay healthy this winter.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Weston, thanks so much for talking with me today and helping me understand the newest COVID vaccine rollout.
No, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Ben Weston is an associate professor of emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also Milwaukee County's chief health policy advisor. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. the Wisconsin Historical Society has a collection of political artifacts. Everything from campaign buttons, signs, and some unique items, like peanuts from Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign. Today, the Society is collecting modern political memorabilia as the presidential election draws closer. Abby Norderhow is the state archivist and director of acquisitions at the Wisconsin Historical Society. WUWM's Eddie Morales met with her at the State Archive Preservation Facility in Madison, and she explains what they've collected from this year's political campaigns.
Why is it important to collect political artifacts, especially during an election year?
It's important to collect political artifacts for a number of reasons. The Wisconsin Historical Society has been collecting, preserving, and sharing stories since the 19th century. And it's important to collect things in the moment so that we have access to the story as it's unfolding. If you wait years to collect something, you are collecting what folks have saved for you. But if you're collecting it proactively in the moment, you can look at the issues that are important to people at the time and make sure that you're representing them in your historical collection.
What criteria does the Wisconsin Historical Society use to determine the significance of a political artifact?
So we're a nonpartisan agency, so we work really hard to ensure that we're collecting both sides of the story. And we look at what current events are happening, what's in the news, what sort of things seem to be the main issues for the different political parties, and try to make sure that we are collecting artifacts or paper material that document those items.
How does the Society collaborate with political campaigns, community organizations, or the general public to acquire items?
So we're really lucky in that people in Wisconsin have been very generous over the years to donate material that they've collected about political events and other events. So we work with a lot of members of the public who approach us and ask if we would be interested in specific items. For the RNC and the DNC, we reached out to delegates and people attending the convention, both before and during the convention, to ask for their help in collecting items. We realized at the RNC that delegates were given certain items when they were on the floor of the convention or even at delegate gatherings pre-convention, and we wanted to make sure we were including those in our documentation. So it's really working in partnership with people in the community to make sure that we're capturing the whole story of an event.
What are some of the oldest items in the collection?
We have political items going back to really early elections in the state in the 19th century. Our oldest artifacts predate white settlement in the state, of course, back to the archaeological past. So we have items from political campaigns like when Teddy Roosevelt was campaigning in the state of Wisconsin in 1912. We have things up to, obviously, the current conventions as well as conventions in the 1960s.
If you could pick out just like a couple of really unique items or just ones that you want to highlight.
So one of the items we have here is a ribbon from President Grant's 1868 presidential campaign. It shows an eagle as well as Grant and a wreath and American flags. And what's interesting about this is it also references the Civil War because it talks about his Richmond campaign in 1865. We have a 1964 convention badge from Belle Phillips. Belle was a Milwaukee City Councilwoman. She was the first African-American state delegate for either major political party. So one item we always think is really interesting are these peanuts for Jimmy Carter. I think they're interesting for a couple different reasons. First, Jimmy Carter is so associated with his agriculture, with his farm, and Wisconsin is, of course, an agricultural state, so it's a nice connection there. It's also interesting because we don't have a lot of food in the collection, so a nice souvenir that was handed out at the 1976 Democratic National Convention.
Probably not good anymore, I'm guessing.
I'm guessing not. They look pretty good, all things considered, right now. Yeah, at the RNC, they were selling President Donald Trump-branded cereal. And there was also a table selling sort of oatmeal-style cereal, so both kind of a traditional cereal box and then that round canister of oatmeal that we're all familiar with.
So there's decades of these types of items, right? Like, I see a variety of things here. There's pins, and that's still something that's used today. This is looks like a tie here.
Yeah, it's a re-elect President Roosevelt tie. I think one thing I noticed at both the RNC and the DNC was the fashion and people really dressing in support of their candidate or dressing for a particular cause. This is a maroon, white, and gold fringed banner from the Democratic National Convention in 1912. It says Wisconsin in red writing across the top. And this convention was held in Baltimore. And what's interesting to me about this banner is it actually came back to Wisconsin and was found in a home in Milwaukee in the 1950s.
Can you explain the significance of like having these specific items just in total kind of laid out here and displayed?
I think what's really interesting about these items is you see how political campaigns have changed over the years, but also how they stay the same. You know, we have buttons from the 60s. We collected buttons at the recent convention. So something like a candidate button is still a really common political item. You can see on this table we have yard signs. Obviously, we see yard signs popping up for this current election as well. So the items that we pulled here, like I said, we are a nonpartisan organization, so we made sure that we had a representative sample of national elections, but there's also local election items in here as well.
I'm seeing over here some pretty new items, if you could describe this little collection here.
Absolutely. So these are items that came from the RNC in Milwaukee and then the DNC in Chicago. These are a couple of the kind of the staff favorite items that we picked up. So we have a cheese head. This was worn on night four of the Republican National Convention. Wisconsin delegates on night four decided that they would wear cheese heads because the Texas delegation had been wearing cowboy style hats, and it was sort of a friendly rivalry between the two states. We have an RNC branded t-shirt, and then on the back of this is the image of President Trump with his post-assassination attempt with his ear bleeding. We found this. It was made by a local Wisconsin vendor who wanted to get a t-shirt with that image made close to the convention to highlight that moment in history.
Are these items all donated or some of them purchased? How does that work?
The items on here are a mix of things. So the cheese head was donated. We purchased the shirt from the vendor. The clear plastic RNC tote, which was given to all delegates, and the convention had buses for transportation, and it was a requirement to be on those buses that your material was in the clear plastic tote. That was donated as well. The material from the DNC, so we have a souvenir program, a Harris Walls hat, and then a Kamala t-shirt that was purchased at the convention.
How do older artifacts compare with contemporary ones, and does that tell us anything about how campaign messaging has changed over time?
I think that they're actually similar in many ways. You see that the use of buttons, we have buttons back to much earlier campaigns, we have them for today's campaigns. A lot of the messaging is not necessarily similar, but done in the same way. So a lot of a name in a large font and then a slogan in slightly smaller font underneath, often leaning on kind of red, white, or blue color like you'd expect. I think the 90s campaign material that we have, and even into the 50s and 60s, tends to have candidate faces more than just names. But sort of that general use of buttons has been pretty consistent.
Going back to the conventions, what were interactions like with people at both the RNC and DNC, and how did collecting the artifacts take place? You've touched on a little bit of this, but if you can elaborate on that.
Yeah. So at both conventions, we were able to identify Wisconsin delegates, usually by cheese heads. Otherwise, they did have badges on, so you could look at the states where people were from. And we had a lot of really great conversations with people. We always made sure to introduce ourselves as here from the Wisconsin Historical Society, explain a little bit about why we were doing this collecting. And people were really receptive and really excited about the idea of helping collect history and helping preserve history.
For the radio specifically, are there any items that like have any kind of sound?
What a good question. No.
Okay. It was worth asking.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and absolutely something we should think about. Yeah, if you can music, sing, make a song. Yeah.
Well, actually, that's an interesting item. Is there more that you can tell me about that one? And then maybe I won't ask for you to sing, if you could just read some of the lyrics, that would actually be great.
Nobody wants me to sing. All right, so we have a red banner with a picture of Teddy Roosevelt on it, and sheet music on that bandana as well, for a song called "We Want Teddy." This was used in 1912, and the bandana was in use at the Milwaukee Auditorium during Roosevelt's speech in 1912. This was when Roosevelt was running as a progressive candidate, and this particular event is notable because there was an assassination attempt on Teddy Roosevelt that same day, and he gave the speech in Milwaukee after surviving that assassination attempt.
Thank you for that. And then if you don't mind just reading a couple of lines.
So the song starts, "Have you heard the people's call? We want Teddy," shouting loud and louder. And then the chorus is, "Wave your bandanas, float the bull moose banners, shout for Teddy, hurrah, hurrah. Wave your red bandana, float the bull moose banners, vote for Teddy, hurrah, hurrah."
How can people see the artifacts online and in person?
So some of our artifacts are available on our website. We are also currently creating a digital asset management system, which will have an increased items from our collection in it. We currently have our museum closed because we are opening a new Wisconsin History Center in 2027. But if somebody is interested in any of these, they should always reach out to our reference staff or a curator, and we can send them higher resolution images, or in certain instances, it might be possible for someone to see the original.
And if you can speak to this, will there be a permanent exhibition for some of these artifacts?
These will likely be used in displays over time. Probably not a permanent display of things, but I can imagine us doing exhibits related to campaigns, related to political events in Wisconsin. So it wouldn't surprise me to see some of these on display at some point.
You know, as we approach the election in November, is there anything else that the society is looking to collect or keeping their eyes on?
We're always looking to expand our political collection. We documented the Republican Party and the Democratic Party at their conventions. We're looking to document third-party candidates or third-party events that may be happening. If anybody was at one of those conventions and brought something home that they think is particularly meaningful, we would love to speak with them about that. And we're always looking for political material to add to our collection.
Abby Norderhow is the State Archivist and Director of Acquisitions at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales at the State Archive Preservation Facility in Madison. You can see pictures of some of the items they spoke about at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the Wisconsin origin story of the popular role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons. But first, there's a documentary about the wetlands outside Madison, screening in Milwaukee this weekend. We'll tell you about the film coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A new documentary explores the wild wetlands just outside Madison, Wisconsin. It's the work of Ben Albert, a 24-year-old Milwaukee filmmaker whose grandparents have lived next door to the Wabisa wetlands for decades. Albert is guided by the wisdom of his grandfather, a retired environmental studies professor. The film is called An Invitation to Wonder, Wabisa Wetlands. Albert joins WUWM's Lena Tran ahead of a film screening at Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Festival this week.
How did this project get started?
So this film was really inspired by my grandparents. My grandparents live in Madison, Wisconsin, and basically out their back door is this wetland called Wabisa Wetlands. And they've lived there for over 50 years, and my grandpa specifically is just so in love with this place. He basically has spent, you know, most of his life dedicated to studying it and exploring it and kind of building awareness around this ecosystem, eventually leading it to be protected as a state natural area, so it's now permanently protected. Which he worked with his neighbors in like the local town to buy land easements and purchase the land around the wetland and protect it, which is a whole nother story. So I was really, really interested in kind of my grandfather's perspective, why he loved this place so much. And also as a kid, they would take my siblings and I out into the wetlands almost every Friday growing up. I guess the film started in the spring of 2020. You know, I had just decided to not go back to film school. I had been in film school for 2 years. And I had kind of remembered, you know, those experiences as a kid in the wetland and also just talking to my grandpa and like hearing his passion and love for this place and realizing that there might be a story there. Basically, it was an interesting time in my life. It was COVID had just...
2020.
Spring of 2020. So COVID was in full swing, and I was a little bit lost at that time, didn't really know what I was doing with my life, and I thought, like, what better way, you know, what better use of my time than to try to, like, put everything into making this film. So then I spent a solid 6 months filming total. The first 3 months were, you know, at my grandparents' house every day. For the first few months, I actually slept in my car because I was worried about, you know, COVID, obviously, and I didn't want to get them sick. And eventually upgraded to a tent in their backyard. And then, you know, going out basically every day and just exploring this place and capturing it with my camera and learning from my grandpa and his experience.
So were you, like, going out into the wetlands every day and then coming home and just peppering your granddad with questions? Like, what did you hope to accomplish, or what did you think that you were going to get?
Mm-hmm. Great question. You know, I knew that there was a story there, and I wasn't really sure what it was. So my intention was just, through spending the time there and you know, exploring it every day and going out with my camera, that kind of naturally, like, the film would develop. And that's also my grandfather's, like, way of teaching. So he kind of told me when we had talked about, you know, making this film, he gave me, like, some hints about what I should look for and what I should capture, but he really wanted to just give me the opportunity to discover the wetland for myself. Interestingly enough, that became kind of like the foundation of the film in a way, because it really is about my own, like, discovery of the wetland, being someone who doesn't have a scientific background. And it kind of allows the film to be more approachable, I think, to a general audience, because they're kind of, like, going on that journey with me.
Yeah. And so over the months and over the weeks that you were going into the wetlands, what did you notice about how you were experiencing them and how that changed over time?
Mm-hmm. So wetlands are an extremely difficult ecosystem to film in. And I think even beyond that, just as a casual, like, viewer, or, you know, someone who's maybe a little bit into the outdoors but doesn't go out that much, they're, like, kind of an intimidating environment to explore. I think that was also a goal of the film, was to kind of create a better portrayal of these places. But when you first go into a wetland, it kind of is just, like, it seems, you know, just like this green, wet place that doesn't really have that much interesting things happening, and it also is just, like, very, as I said, everything is soaking wet, so you're going to get soaked if you are walking through a wetland, and the vegetation is, you know, very hard to navigate through, even with, like, a canoe, which I was doing. In the evenings, you're getting swarmed by mosquitoes and all these other insects. So it kind of is a very hostile place to people, you know, as a, like, at a first impression. But I found, you know, after spending day and day going out, that you kind of get past that, and then you begin to really see, like, what makes wetlands so special. And I think the biggest thing is just that there's just such an abundance of life and biodiversity in wetlands. They're one of the most biodiverse ecosystems on the whole planet. So, like, every day, like, I would notice something new, this new species or this new bird, or, you know, also seeing the different levels of life. Like, in the water, there's all these, like, smaller organisms that you can see, and it's just this very complicated system. It kind of, like, reveals over time how complicated it is. It's the type of place where the more time you spend there, like, the less you really understand about it.
So you must have, I mean, you were working really closely with your grandfather on this project. Was that a new dynamic to your relationship? Like, what was that like?
I think he always talks about these things, even outside of working on the film. He's always sharing about what he sees in the wetland and what he's working on. And he's 88 years old now, and he still is, you know, writing books and doing presentations and sharing about the wetland and his work. You know, I've kind of been around that my whole life, so it wasn't that new in a way. The first few months, I mean, it was during COVID, we did have conversations, but it was mostly I would go out into the marsh, he would be on the porch drinking his coffee. We would check in once in the evening. And then later on, you know, I conducted 3 to 4 interviews of him. So we spent a lot of time together and definitely got to know each other better. I think it reminded me actually a lot of like kind of what I care about as a person. And it was very inspiring to be, you know, to be learning from him and his love for learning, love for science, love for these places. I think it definitely like inspired me to keep going with the film and also, you know, keep pursuing this type of work as a career.
Yeah. Well, it was really delightful to get to know your grandfather through the film. What do you hope people take away from it?
I think the overall goal is to give people like just this hopeful story. We have a lot of stories and a lot of films that portray the negative things that are happening to our natural worlds and the climate and all these kind of existential threats to the planet. And I think that kind of, you know, there's a place for that storytelling for sure, because there are these very big threats. But I think it also kind of can disconnect people even more from the natural world, make it feel like this thing that they don't really have control over anymore, like, you know, it's almost hopeless. I think we really need to change our perspective and see ourselves as being part of the natural world. And, you know, there still is a lot all around us that needs our care and our protection. And I think the first step in that is getting people to just kind of pause and take a moment to discover what's actually around them. So a major goal was that, you know, this is in Wisconsin and there is all this biodiversity and all this life and these mysteries and wonder that are like right here, like 20 minutes from Madison. And like, yes, Wabisa Wetlands is, you know, a 1,000 acres and it's a larger wetland and it has a long history, but there are other places like that. And even if it's doesn't go back thousands of years, there, you know, like even a forest near you or a prairie near you like supports all this life that is critical to, I mean, we're kind of to the point where we need to hold on to these places, you know, for the survival of species on our planet and ourselves too, because we're connected to it. The overall goal is just an invitation to get people to look at what's around them and discover, you know, what's in their own backyard. And, you know, one thing my grandpa says that I think was like a big takeaway from this project was people only protect something that they love. You know, I think the first step in building that love and appreciation is the discovery of it.
Well, so you went to film school for a couple years in Milwaukee. You live in Milwaukee now. Are you super excited to be having your work on the big screen at the Downer?
Very excited. This has been 4 years in the making, and this screening on Friday, September 27th, will be like our first official public screening of the film. And my grandfather will also be joining us that day, so he'll be coming on stage after the film to do a Q&A with me. We also will be having like a local wetland expert from Milwaukee who will also be presenting some kind of the current, like what's happening with wetlands in Wisconsin and what people can do. So it's just very exciting to finally get our message out to the community, and yeah, hopefully it'll be well received.
Ben Albert is the Milwaukee filmmaker behind Invitation to Wonder, Wabisa Wetlands. It's showing this Friday at the Downer Theater as part of Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Fest. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. WUWM is a sponsor of Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Fest. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll explore the Wisconsin roots of Dungeons and Dragons. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Since it was first created in the 1970s, Dungeons & Dragons has become an international phenomenon. It was the first role-playing game with major commercial success, but few know it all began right here in Wisconsin. Writer T. Krulos uncovers this history in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. He joins me now to talk about it. T, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Great to be back.
So we are talking today about a topic that I know a lot of things around, but I never actually played this game. We're talking about Dungeons and Dragons.
Classic.
Yeah. People are actually often surprised to learn that D&D is from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Even folks who are from here. And I think part of that is that the history hasn't necessarily been celebrated locally. But let's dig into it. How did Dungeons and Dragons first come to be?
Yes. Well, it starts with a guy named Gary Gygax and his friend at the time, Dave Arneson. They're both very much into war-playing games and were trying to create their own games. And they kind of put their ideas together and formed this game that really revolutionized the gaming industry called Dungeons & Dragons. And this was the first sort of game where you could interact by sort of becoming one of the characters. You would build your character that was a barbarian or a wizard or some sort of warrior. And then the dungeon master leads your group through this game. And you have to collaborate together to find treasure and fight monsters. And it's a really fun adventure and a way to kind of bond with your fellow game players.
The development of it was interesting. As you say, both Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were very into war games. I believe that's how they met. Mm-hmm. And Gary, I know, had designed a game called Chainmail.
Right.
This ended up being kind of a game that was really focused on the rules. But as you say, Arneson brought in this idea of kind of character play.
Yeah. Arneson had been working on a game called Blackmoor. So, you know, they kind of took some of the best elements of both of those games and created this entirely new thing.
Yeah. Now, as someone who grew up in Lake Geneva, I actually knew Gary Gygax quite well. I also had friends whose parents worked at TSR, which was the company that he made. That has a really complicated history in the city of Lake Geneva. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I mean, one thing that I really love about the story is that Lake Geneva developed this big company. So at one point, they employed like about 400 people, which is a pretty good part of the population of Lake Geneva. You know, they kind of took over the town and imported all of these writers and artists and game editors. And it just must have been like such an exciting time. But, you know, there were some Game of Thrones-style twists to the company, I would say. First, Gygax and Arneson had a bad falling out, and Arneson had to take legal action so he could get a piece of game royalties. And then Gary went from being very poor to being pretty rich in a short amount of space. And I think that a lot of people don't know how to handle that influx of money. So he didn't spend it very wisely, and eventually his own company ousted him from the company in the mid-80s. The new head was a woman named Lorraine Williams, and she ran the company until the late 90s when they were in really bad financial straits, and the company was bought by Wizards of the Coast, which is a company from the Seattle area that created Magic the Gathering. So they bought the company, and they still own it and are producing the game. And it's really kind of amazing. Dungeons & Dragons is still a very popular property, even in this digital age.
It does continue to have a bit of a footprint in Lake Geneva, as you say, a lot of people moved to this small town for this reason. Now, I will say that point in Lake Geneva's history, as somebody who was from there, Lake Geneva also had the Playboy Hotel was just on the outskirts.
Right.
So you have the Playboy Hotel, you have TSR, which is right downtown. It's where the Kilwins ice cream place is now.
Mm-hmm.
And you, of course, had the lake and all of the tourism that came along with the lake that honestly predates all of this, is really from like the Great Chicago Fire when tourism starts in Lake Geneva.
Right.
But with all of that in mind, it still seems like the city hasn't really latched onto this history in quite the way you might expect for such a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah. It's only been in very recent years that this history is sort of acknowledged and celebrated in any way. But yeah, a long period of time went by. But now there is a group called the Gygax Memorial Fund, and they've slowly been getting some recognition in the city. So, for example, there's some memorial markers by like Horticultural Hall, which is where the first Gen Con took place.
Con named for
the Geneva Convention. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that, especially because it's not in Wisconsin anymore, unfortunately. But that's where it started, and it was a very small, humble event. And now it's the largest gaming convention in North America. So 70,000 plus people go to Gen Con nowadays. And it started with less than 100 people. So the Gygax Memorial Fund has also set up a reading alcove in the Lake Geneva Library, which is a beautiful library, by the way. And this alcove includes books that were influential on Gary Gygax, you know, so there's a lot of works by J.R.R. Tolkien and H.P. Lovecraft and stuff like that. And probably the biggest thing that they've been working on, and they've just gotten Lake Geneva to approve this, is they're building a memorial statue of Gary Gygax in the park near the library. And it's going to feature him sitting at a table. And I love this detail. His hand is outstretched, and it's what's called a dice tower. So you drop dice, and it'll come shooting out of his hand onto the table. And people can sit there with him at this table and play Dungeons & Dragons or read a book or do whatever they want. So that's a project that they're currently working on.
Yeah. I was chatting with Gary's widow, Gail Gygax, and I believe they're even going to print some of his original games on the table itself.
Right, yes. Ones that he designed, yeah.
Yeah.
They're also having a Dragon Days celebration, which is the weekend of September 28th. And it's kind of a fun small-town fair meets Ren Fair, sort of a mashup. There's like a they're setting up some hay bales, so there's a maze that kids can go through. And there's vendors and special readings and screenings of the old Dungeons & Dragons cartoon, which was a brief thing in the 80s. So it's just kind of a fun weekend where the local businesses are celebrating this history.
Very nice. Well, T, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
T. Krulos is a writer and author. His piece on the history of Dungeons & Dragons is featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. The Dragon Days Fantasy Festival will be held this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Finally today, September 25th, is National One-Hit Wonder Day. These are songs that see great success. They're often overplayed on the radio, used in films, and can be hummed along to years after they've faded into memory. But the musician or band that puts out that song also fades away into obscurity, having only come up with one popular song. Here are a few memorable one-hit wonders through the decades.
Tequila.
The hippie to the hippie to hip hip.
the hopper, you don't stop. Rock it to the bang, bang the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogity bead. Well, skiddle bee bop, we rock a Scooby-Doo. And guess what, America, we love you. Because you rock and roll with us so much so. You can rock till you're 101 years old. I don't mean to brag, I don't mean to boast. But we like hot butter on a...
Pump up the volume, pump up the volume, pump up the volume. Dance, dance.
In my life, a little bit of Erica by my side, a little bit of Rita's all I need, a little bit of Tina's what I see, a little bit of Sandra in the sun, a little bit of
Those one-hit wonders wrap up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about the Milwaukee Public Library's Great Lakes Marine Collection. Plus, we'll help you plan a trip to Horican Marsh to catch fall bird migration. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWN, Milwaukee's NPR.
We play.